Hey, podcasters, welcome to another edition of Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. As usual, I'm your host, Tim Estradol, and joining me once again from the Windy City is Jill Simonello.
Good morning.
I feel like I need to bump that up a little bit. I didn't quite nail it this time. I don't know. It's the Michigan effect. We're too close by.
Well, so, or vacation effect, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of late nights with my brother. All right, so yes, I am within reach of Jill. No, actually, I'm within a time zone away. We are much closer today, and so as a result, we're both eating lunch as we do this podcast. And there's lots of exciting news we should get to. I should stop bantering. Lots of exciting news to get to this week, and we have a really cool interview. Dan Edmonds of Edmonds.com, no relation, nothing. He doesn't own the company. Anyways, he was on the podcast talking about the Honda Ridgeline torture test that we had talked about last week, and had very great information. He's a very very well-spoken individual, and he has a very deep engineering background, and so he has some really good thoughts on engineering and the math of it and why the shocks blew out, and really good stuff, really good material. Make sure you check that out after the break. But first, the news. All right, Ford trucks celebrating 100 years. Yeah, that's kind of what I have for that. Congrats, Ford. I mean, really. Congrats to our friends over in Dearborn. That is a fantastic achievement to have 100 years and being the truck sales leader for, my gosh, decades upon decades. So really good stuff there. Really good. Proud of them. The 2018 Ford F-150 also. Police Responder is out now. They just unveiled this. This is the first of its kind, ready-to-go, police-equipped pickup. A lot of pickups you can see in the West. Yes, we use pickups as police cars. I don't know if you knew that, Joe. But we do that, are modified. This is straight from factory. It's basically an FX4 package with, you know, your police stickers, your lights, and it's got additional amplify. It's a high output 240 amp alternator. And that's basically the difference, because the alternator's got to support all the onboard electronic devices and the lights and the speedometer, and it has to idle. So big amp in there, big amp alternator.
So I have to say, we use Ford Explorers as cop cars in Chicago.
Really?
I see a white Ford Explorer, I'm like, put on brakes. Anywhere, because it's drummed into my head. But Ford Explorers, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I can see that, because you can have people in the back and you can sit up a little higher. But yeah, it's I don't know. I got an argument years ago with a gentleman who didn't understand the purpose of trucks. And he was from New Jersey, whatever it is. And he was arguing with me about the purpose of trucks. And I told him I use them as police vehicles. And he's like, shut up, you do not. And so in my town, they have one. So I happened to take a photo of it, send it to him. And we had a spirited discussion. You know, the reality is, with technology these days and radios and all the nine yards, I mean, you don't do really, there's not as much high speed chasing as there used to be. And there's a lot more enforcement issues as far as getting off-road and finding different enforcement issues. Moonshining would be one example. You need a truck for to get up there. Anyways, so the Ford, that's right, I heard it here first. 2018 Ford F-150 Police Responder for catching moonshiners. that's the big Ford news. I'm sorry, folks, this was a slow week for news. We do have a recall.
Yes.
And does it happen to be a Ford recall as well?
It does. It is a Ford.
Oh my gosh, this is like the Ford podcast going out so far.
All Ford all the time, apparently.
Okay, so they celebrate 100 years and recall some vehicles. So what do we got?
Yeah, so it's an interesting recall. It's 117,000 vehicles, which is kind of a large number. You know, often I put out a recalls recap every week for Auto Matters on the Sinclair websites, and most recalls are like 12,000 of this, 5,000 of that, but this is 117,000 vehicles. And it's basically because bolts can fracture. And it's the bolts.
No.
Bolts can fracture. But bolts in the seat, the seatbelt, or the seatbelt buckle may fracture. So when that happens, obviously, if you're in an accident, seatbelts aren't going to work.
Could potentially
be a problem. They said that they haven't had any, they're not aware of any accidents or injuries or anything like that related to the defect, but apparently, if they're not aware of any accidents or injuries, like, how do they know that the bolts fracture? Ooh, that would be my question.
Deep thoughts with Jill.
I know. And this is what happens when you get me after I did a speed workout last night, so I'm a little bit brain dead today. So, apologies.
But you're well aware of how bolts fracture. That's interesting. I don't know how bolts fracture. I don't know how they find this stuff sometimes. It's, I don't know. It's like a random testing, I guess they do, and they figure stuff out. It's interesting. Okay, so that's the recall. So let's get on to two articles I wrote today on pickuptrucktalk.com. You can find them on there. Again, pickuptrucktalk.com. I wrote two articles that are opinion articles. One is on fuel economy, and it specifically deals with CAFE. And CAFE, for those who don't know, is the corporate average fuel economy. It has been in place since 1975 when the U.S. Congress voted it in. And it was in response to the Arab oil crisis. And it's meant to improve the fuel economy of vehicles sold in the U.S. so we can get off foreign oil and everybody gets better fuel economy. And people remember, I don't know, was it probably 4 or 5 years ago now, Obama's 54.5 mile per gallon target. That was the idea. They raised the stakes. And when President Trump got in office, they wanted to change that. Automakers went to President Trump and said it was unfair, and they want to do an environmental review of those CAFE standards. So that's where he stands. So they're doing a review of the CAFE standards. There's many pieces to the puzzle here in that CAFE is good and bad. It's got pros and cons. The pros are the trucks we drive today get better than 12 miles per gallon.
Unless I'm driving.
Unless Speedster Jill is driving. Yes, they get better than 12 miles a gallon. The con is that trucks have become more expensive, and it's based on safety equipment's more expensive, technology more expensive, but also that to get these powertrains to be more fuel efficient, we're doing turbochargers, we're doing advanced speed transmissions, we're doing things that increase the price of the truck. So while you're saving at the pump, you're paying more when you purchase the truck, and so there's a pro and con there. And what the automakers have said, and I've talked to Toyota specifically on this, I can't quote him, but we had a conversation about this, is that they just want there to be an environmental review done on the current fuel economy numbers, which is something that they felt should have been done when it was passed through and it didn't get passed through. And what they're saying here is that they want the environmental review of, and this is not, it is not the environment, like the trees and the water. This is the entire marketplace. And I'm waiting for my computer to load to give you the specific quote I pulled out for this that talks about this environmental review. And it says, well, I just missed it, but that's all right. It says they want to look at vehicles. Oh, here we go. Here we go. I'm sorry, folks. I found it. Hold with me a minute. Facts need to drive public policy, including data on consumer sales, gas prices, and costs of technology, and determine the final standards. So let's break this down. As we all know, electric vehicles were supposed to be the next greatest thing, and frankly, they haven't taken off as much as we thought. Still 1% of the population, or 1% of all vehicles sold in the U.S. is electric. Everything else is cars and internal combustion cars. Also, they thought the premise of the 54.5 mile per gallon was going to be that consumers were going to buy smaller cars. Well, we know from sales data that's not happening. They're buying big Suburbans and Tahoes and Yukons and trucks. And they also argue that cost technology, so the increased cost of powertrains, should factor into that as well. So here we go, Jill. Here we go. So the question has been, and I put this out there, we know that fuel economy is a huge thing every automaker tells us about, and we're racing right now for who's going to deliver the best fuel economy in a truck. I theorize that race may come to a close because the incentive to make it more fuel efficient may diminish if we change the fuel economy standards. So here we go. Tell me I'm wrong. I know you're dying to.
I don't think
you're
wrong.
Oh, no. Hey. Well, look at that.
And, you know, this then feeds into, like, my biggest pet peeve in the automotive world right now is the auto stop-start engines. So, in a way, I have to say, I partially hope that they roll back some of the fuel economy standards, because then people will stop using that awful, awful feature in vehicles.
And that'll make the cars cheaper, you know, because they take that technology out. Yeah.
But, I mean, I think that you're... I think that it could go half, you know, half one way, half the other. If people don't have to comply with standards, they won't. But I'd like to think that the Elon Musks of the world have thrown quite a big electric wrench electrified wrench into the whole automotive industry sphere. And I don't think electric cars are going away. I don't think electrification is going away. And so in the short term, I think you're probably right. Long term, I don't think the combustion engine, again, brain dead, sorry, is a long term solution. I mean, oil and it is a finite resource. We don't have an unlimited supply, anywhere. And so eventually people are going to have to up their standards and look more towards electrification. But I think in the short term, people will be like, hallelujah. We can make less expensive trucks again, and who cares?
Right. So this is going to feed into something else that's a pet peeve of yours. I said in my article towards the end, I said for a long period of time we had a torque wars. People may remember those. So I got 900 foot pounds of torque. I got 950 foot pounds of torque. And they would do these advertisements for torque wars. And then it became fuel economy. So now fuel economy is a big part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. I theorize the next frontier in trucks is going to be technology wars. Mm-hmm. They're going to argue about who's got better technology, 4G LTE, Wi-Fi, wireless charging, mm-hmm. and Android Auto and Apple CarPlay, which I know you're a huge fan of, Jill. I know. You love it.
Hot buttons. You're just hitting my hot buttons today. I think Apple CarPlay is the devil. I've written an article that basically states that. No comment from Apple, by the way, which I did reach out to them.
Really?
And they did not get back to me. But, Google has the technology right now, I think, in terms of Android Auto. But keeping in mind, I'm an Apple. I'm a Mac. So I haven't really tested it. My husband is a PC, and he has Android phones. So I've actually got a BMW M2 this week. And my husband and I are taking a bit of a road trip this weekend. So I'm going to make sure he has downloaded Android Auto, and we are going to hook up his phone to Android Auto for our road trip this weekend. Because one of the big news things this week was that Android Auto now has Waze, which... Again, who needs navigation in a vehicle when you have Waze on your phone? And now you'll actually have Waze that can go onto the projector screen through Android Auto. So I want to test that a little bit and see how that actually works, if it's if the functionality is the same. But to circle back, I do think tech wars are probably the next big thing, because you have pretty much every major automaker except for Toyota that has committed to Android Auto and CarPlay. And, Toyota is still stubbornly sticking to their Entune and connected services. Which I find both altruistic and fascinating. And, if the option is Entune or CarPlay, I'd probably go with Entune at this point. That's how I feel about CarPlay. And Apple Maps are evil.
And to clarify, the Waze is a navigation app.
Yeah.
Okay, for those who don't know, it's a navigation app.
If you are not familiar with Waze, go to, your Google Play Store or your iTunes Store and download it right now. That's all I have to say. It's free.
And, Dr. Jill orders.
It is literally the best navigation app ever, because not only does it give you real-time ETAs, like within a minute, like I have never been more than 10, like more than 2 or 3 minutes off of, when they're like, you're going to be here. Hmm. Whereas when you put your ETA time into like a car, an embedded navigation system, they'll say, oh, you'll be there in 30 minutes. Even with real time traffic, they'll say, you're going to be there in 30 minutes. And like an hour later, you're like, I'm not there yet. So, but Waze is really good about taking crowdsourced data. So basically how this works is, and I'm sorry, this is like something I really find cool, so I'm going to get excited about it. But it's really neat, because like you're driving along and, I always put it on my phone even when I'm a passenger in the vehicle. And if we hit a slowdown, and, you can mark that on the app, and it put like pinpoints where the traffic slowdown is, and then it goes into the ether somewhere. And then when it's calculating the drive times for the next person, it factors that in. So, and if there's an accident, if there's a cop on the road, It pings you and tells you, hey, heads up, there's a, you know, a hidden cop car up ahead. You know, heads up, there's a vehicle on the side of the road. Heads up, there's an accident. And it gives you, the user, the option of saying, yes, there's a cop there. No, there's not a cop there. Yes, there's an accident. No, there's not an accident. So, it, you know, it just gathers all of this real-time data. And the creepy thing, however, is that while you have Waze on, it basically, it'll sometimes say, we've detected that your car has slowed down. Are you in traffic? So, you know, it does monitor you, but I feel like the payback of knowing if there's traffic ahead, an accident ahead, a cop ahead, especially when you're on a really long road trip, is incredibly beneficial. Like if you don't know where the speed traps are. So, and plus I have Mr. T who is telling me, you know, turn now, you know, with little Mr. T voice. But yeah, so you can choose different voices of who's going to be reading your navigation instructions to you. But, that would be my 10 cent, incitation. I don't know, again, brain dead of downloading Waze.
Okay. Yeah. So, this episode brought to you by Waves. So, if you're worried about that Kojak with a Kodak, go ahead and download Waves, and you'll get right on that.
But no, I mean, I think that you have a point that the tech wars are the next thing, and it's, you know, who has the best system, who is most easily integrated. You know, I think a conversation I posted when I posted about the Waze story on my Facebook page, a couple of people were commenting about how they don't like the back and forth between Android Auto and CarPlay and the car's native systems. And so it's going to be how each manufacturer can integrate these systems and make it easy for the driver to use. It's going to be how pretty does it look. You know, on another separate conversation, somebody had pointed out that they hate the Mazda infotainment system, you know, and it's like one of the least user-friendly and ugliest systems out there. It doesn't bother me, but and again, I'm a Mazda fangirl, so of course it's not going to bother me, but you know, so when you look at the initial quality studies for JD Power, I feel like 90% of all comments about initial quality have to do with the telematics systems and the infotainment systems. Yep. So, yep. Again, trying to circle it back to your original question, me and my 10-minute answer of yes, I think you are correct in saying that, you know, technology is the next front.
Yeah, and I think it's going to head that way. I feel like as these cars get more advanced and we integrate our lives more with them, that's got to be the future. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's move on to going backwards a step. Yes, backwards a step. I had an interesting conversation today, and Dan Edmonds, I give him credit, him and I were talking after the interview about some news coming out. So here's the scoop. Something is happening at the LA Auto Show this year that involves Chevy. I do not know what it is, but I have an inkling that they're going to do something truck-related at the LA Auto Show this year. Little Birdie told me something truck's coming. So, or truck or SUV, I'm not really sure. It's something in my realm of coverage. So we were discussing things, and one of the things we discussed was the fact that the Colorado ZR2, the Toyota Tacoma TRD Pro, and I believe the Nissan Frontier Pro 4X all come only in four-wheel drive capability. You cannot buy those trucks in two-wheel drive. And he's in California. If you do California, Arizona, Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, you don't need four-wheel drive. You're going to hit the, if you go through the desert, you use two-wheel drive. You're going to go through the mud, it's horsepower. It's not, it doesn't matter four-wheel drive, whatever. It's just all horsepower to get through there. So I theorized that Chevy could easily build a Chevy Colorado two-wheel drive ZR2. They could take the weight out. They could increase fuel economy by 1 mile per gallon. They could drop the weight. That's from the weight loss. They could make it in a pretty easy thing. All I got to do is take it back and tune the suspension up with the difference in the weights, and they could actually battle Toyota better. So California is the mid-sized truck capital of the U.S. There's more mid-sized trucks sold in L.A. to San Diego than anywhere else in the country. It's similar to like Texas sells a lot of full-size trucks, California a lot of mid-size. So the pre-runner back in the day, Toyota Tacoma pre-runner, was just a two-wheel drive Tacoma. And Dan was telling me, you see them all the time out there. You see lifted kits with a little bit tuned engine, more power, and off-road wheels, and you're ready to go, and you have a good time. So I theorize that's where Chevy's going to head. You do the Canyon too. They could have a GMC Canyon that well, because there's 7,000 units, about 7,000 units a month vehicle gap between the Colorado and Tacoma. And so if they do this and they do it well, it could put a lot of pressure on Toyota. And I'm going to bring you in here, Jill. I'm going to give you something to actually talk about, because I know you were like, "Well, yeah, it's a two-wheel drive truck, and I don't know." All right, so look. So Toyota has said, and we've previously discussed this, that they're going to re-energize the midsize car segment with the Camry. So they're doing that stuff with the Camry. And so what do you think is going to happen if Toyota starts getting their butts kicked in the midsize market? They've been the king of the hill for a long, long time. Do you think that Toyota... I have some experience with Toyota. I know that they're a very conservative Japanese company, and they make changes very slowly. Do you think they could adapt to changing marketplace that quickly? Do you think that they could really put up a big fight?
You know, so what's really interesting when you say that, you look at the Asian automakers, and you've got like Hyundai, Kia, Nissan, Toyota, and Mazda. And I would say that probably the quickest moving automakers are like Hyundai and Kia. Mm-hmm. You know, they listen to, like, I feel like they read every review that every journalist ever writes. They look at every tweet that every consumer puts out there. And, you know, they make their decisions based on this feedback that they get. And, you know, Toyota, you're right. They move a little slower than that. And, you know, now that we're in this age of, like, instant gratification and immediate notification, yeah, you got to move a little faster.
Well, we talked to technology before. You've used the Intune system, mm-hmm. and you used the Chevrolet MyLink system. And I think the Chevrolet MyLink system looks better. It looks prettier. Mm-hmm. It has a better interface. I think the Intune is fine. Mm-hmm. But then you look at Chevy, they do the 4G LTE Wi-Fi. They do the Android Auto, Apple CarPlay. They have those features in those trucks. As a consumer, you know, as you've driven around different vehicles as a consumer, I would argue that technology is going to hurt Toyota the most in technology worlds and wars.
Well, either that or it's going to save them. You know, I'm not convinced that Apple CarPlay or Android Auto is the thing moving forward. You know, until they can refine it and make it better. Because right now it's still really clunky. And I think Toyota is just kind of holding out to see what happens. And yeah, they're being conservative and cautious, but I don't know that they're wrong in that. Because so many people just have so many negative things to say about Apple CarPlay. And so it's like, oh, and Chevrolet and Apple CarPlay, you can't, like, if you have a playlist called, you know, Zappa, you can't scroll through down to Zappa to get to, because it only lets you page through three screens. It limits you, you know, and you know, you know, the voice recognition on this is bad. So I even tried to say, you know, play playlist Zappa, and you can't get there. And so, you know, so then it's like Chevrolet is bad because Apple CarPlay doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so, but nobody's necessarily saying, well, Toyota is bad because this thing doesn't work. I mean, they're saying, okay, yeah, maybe this isn't pretty, but it works. So I don't know. I just wrote an article about breaking down the connected services from Toyota. And my thing with the technology isn't necessarily that it doesn't work or that it's not pretty. It's just about the cost. Because if you get all of their connected features, I mean, you're going to be spending between $60 and $100 a month to get, like, Wi-Fi and service updates and navigation. Like, after the trial periods end, like, every navigation feature that they offer will cost you a subscription fee. So back to my whole, you know, just get Waze and be done with it. But I don't know. I mean, I never thought that people would pay 99 cents a song on iTunes, that people wouldn't, you know, and I do it. Well, this is a great song. It will be great in my workout thing. So I'll pay 99 cents for that. So I figured people wouldn't, you know, this is several years ago, but I figured people would only want the albums or whatever. And to pay 99 cents a song is obviously more than buying the whole album if you, like, parse it out and whatever. But at any rate, so I don't know what the cost problems are now. I mean, maybe they're thinking further ahead than we think they are. So maybe they're ahead of the game and we just don't know it yet because we're not there.
You are just full of deep thoughts today. It's just, it's actually really impressive. And I think we need to take a break because I just got to process all this deep thinking. This is going to be deep because Dan Edmonds is up next and he has some really deep thoughts too. This is going to be the analytical podcast brought to you by Ford and the Waze app. Right back with more Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. And up next on Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk, we have Dan Edmonds. He is the Director of Vehicle Testing at Edmonds.com. And no, it's no relation. Just happens to be just an interesting coincidence. So welcome to the podcast, Dan.
Thank you. And thanks, Tim.
We're going to talk about the Death Valley torture test you did recently with a Honda Ridgeline, a Toyota Tacoma TRD, and a Nissan Titan Pro4X. But I want to play the video, or I want to play your audio from a video that you had put out the first time. So I'm going to hit play here.
We're headed to the racetrack Playa, which is a dry lake in a very remote part of Death Valley. And you have to drive 25 miles on this dirt road to get there. And here's the turnoff. And so it begins.
Now, I played that for the audience. Just give an idea that your jaw is shaking the entire time you're talking. Like, did you have to take some Advil when you got there for the pain in the jaw?
Well, you'd have thought. Yeah, that is a washboard road that's pretty notorious. Well, I don't know if it's notorious. I don't think a lot of people expect it. But it's not like just any washboard road. And it's actually 27 miles. I misspoke there. Oh. So a couple extra miles even tacked on to that.
All right, so let's give the audience an idea here. The plan is take the Ridgeline out because the prior editor had taken it out and blown some shocks. And you were just going to go to the track. You were thinking the track was going to be the story, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the idea was, it's a new Ridgeline. Let's see if the new amplitude reactive dampers they added to it, which is something I learned in the intro when they did the press reveal in San Antonio a year and a half ago. Let's see if that makes any difference. And so we just decided to recreate his trip, which was just go out to the racetrack, have a look at the rocks, turn around and come back. You know, that's pretty much what the first editor did. So we figured, well, we'll recreate as much of this as we can. And, you know, I talked to him, tried to figure out exactly how he drove it, how the truck was loaded, and what he did with tire pressures and all of that. And so we did the same thing. And basically, when I started talking to other people around the office about it, they started to get excited because, you know, I think a lot of people have heard about the racetrack, you know, where the rocks move. Nobody knows why. And so they wanted to go out and check it out, too. And so we ended up having more people than seats. And so the Tacoma came along and then somebody said, well, let's videotape this. And then there was the Titan, all the gear. And so it turned into a whole thing. And there were five of us instead of just me.
Right. And so you go out there, and if you haven't seen this video yet, it's on Edmund's YouTube channel. It's also on pickuptrucktalk.com. We have a post on it. If you're watching the video, you're driving along, and then you stop, and you notice that the trucks aren't really behaving like they should. What did you find?
Well, it's funny because one guy had dropped back, and we didn't know where he was, so we figured we'd pull over and wait. And we started, joking around, tossing rocks. And then I figured I'd go over and look at the Tacoma and the Ridgeline, mainly because we smelled something and it seemed like it was coming from the Tacoma. And I didn't really expect to see much. And then I was kind of joking around. Well, let's see if there's any oil here. You know, it was kind of total sarcasm. And then I stuck my head in there and I was totally gobsmacked because I couldn't even see the boot. I didn't really understand what I wasn't seeing there for a few minutes. And yeah, there was just oil everywhere. The boot was melted to the point where it telescoped over the shock body and I could just see the rod and there was a chunk of the seal missing and all the oil was gone. And you're seeing genuine surprise there on the video. And then walked around to the other side, saw the same thing.
Yeah.
It was pretty weird.
And you have experience though with Tacomas and Toyotas. You were initial program for the TRD. And so you have to be double surprised at what you found.
Yeah, back in the 90s when the TRD off-road package was first conceived, Actually, when it was first conceived, it was just called an off-road package. The name TRD didn't get applied to it till the end. So I was at the Arizona Proving Ground. You know, my job was to tune suspensions there. And okay, so I'm going to do an off-road package for the Tacoma. You know, that at first was just going to be shocks, but, you know, I talked people into springs and shocks, and then they wanted to do a tire. And so we picked B.F. Goodrich and Bill Stein because that was what was on Ivan Stewart's truck. And Ivan was tearing up Baja at that time. And, you know, the concept for the truck, at least in my mind, was more of a Baja-style off-road type of thing rather than rock crawling. Because, you know, it's a pickup, not a Jeep. And we wanted to tie into that. So anyway, that was kind of the goal. And yeah, so we worked with Bill Stein engineers, tuned the shocks and all of that. But one of the problems was, as you see there, and as you'll see, as you'll see in a subsequent write-up I've done, those shocks are the skinny 36 millimeter ones, the smallest ones in Bill Stein's catalog. And, you know, on the first generation Tacoma, that meant one thing, but this truck's 850 pounds heavier than the first generation truck. So I was totally surprised that they were still using them, frankly. And but that didn't really sink in until after, you know, a day or two had passed. And I really thought about what had gone on. At the time, I was just like blown away that this could happen on a washboard road.
Yeah, I mean, you weren't doing high speeds. You were just driving along, and it totally destroyed those shocks. There was some conversation about whether or not to air down the tires, and I've talked to some people that who've brought that point up, that should have been aired down. So where do you stand on the airing down of the tire issue?
Well, I mean, I air down when I go off-roading all the time, like a lot of people do. But, I mean, I don't know if people would consider a washboard dirt road off-roading. This is just a dirt road that's been graded. It's, you know, fairly well maintained. There's no washouts, no holes. It's just washboard. And so on that basis, maybe people wouldn't air down because it's a pain. You got to put it back in. And especially when you're 100 miles away from civilization, even once you get back on the pavement, because, you know, the air in the tires is what bears the weight of the vehicle. So if your vehicle's loaded down with gear and all of that, if you're creeping along at 15 miles an hour on trail, that's one thing. But if you're going 60 miles an hour down the freeway before you get to, well, actually in this case, two lane roads in Death Valley, before you get to a gas station, you know, 60 miles an hour with 15 PSI of air in your tire, not a good idea. Right. But in any event, you know, this is more like, I approached this the way I would have approached it working at Toyota back in the day, and that is we assumed that the customer didn't air down, even though a lot of people do. And actually, the automakers, if you read through their manuals, they won't recommend that you air down because the air is necessary to maintain the load capacity of the tire. And so anyway, we did all our testing back in the day at full pressure. And that was the way I would have approached it had I been wearing the Toyota hat in 1993. But this time we did it that way because we wanted to duplicate what the guy had done back in 2005 with the first generation Ridgeline. So we did the same thing again.
Yeah, so you do the same kind of testing. The Ridgeline passes now, and the Tacoma blows the shocks. The Titan loses like pieces off the bed. I mean, it's kind of a disaster there. But you were talking in the video how you had taken the previous shocks from the original Honda Ridgeline and had talked to the Honda engineers, and they had really studied that. So what's your explanation for why the Tacoma did so poorly on those trails? With the size of the shocks, or is it just not testing? It just seems odd to me that they wouldn't test for that kind of environment.
I think you know, it's all very confusing to me too, until I kind of looked at everything in detail. You know, the Bilsteins, being monotube shocks, they have single wall, so they should be really good at rejecting heat, right? But you know, if you look at the math here, you know, these washboard inputs are only about an inch tall at the most. You know, a lot of times washboard roads are less than that. They're generally 16 to 18 inches apart. And if you do the math, that's 3,000 to 4,000 impacts per mile. Now, that's a lot when you start making that into 10 miles. You know, that's, we're into 40,000 impacts, cycles. The whole trip's getting close to 250,000. That's a lot of heat. And as long as there's enough capacity to get rid of that heat, then you won't have a problem. But as I said, this is the smaller of the two Bilsteins that you commonly see. There's a 36 millimeter and a 46 millimeter. And the larger 46 would hold 68% more oil. There'd be, I did the math on this, so that's why I got the numbers in my head.
I was very impressed.
That's what I do. It's like 28% more surface area for the heat to radiate out. So the 46 could probably have kept up. I don't know. That's a theory, but it's something I'd like to try. Certainly the 46 is what you see on the back of the Frontier Pro 4X. Somebody commented to the YouTube channel, hey, I had a buddy with a Frontier. He didn't have this problem. Well, he had the bigger shocks. You know, the ZR2, the S10 ZR2 back in the day, that was the reference vehicle we used when we developed the original TRD off-road package. That had 46 millimeter Bilsteins on the back. So, I mean, we're dealing with a lot less oil and a lot less surface area, but the same kind of road input. So I think it's just a question of that one couldn't keep up. Now, in the case of the Ridgeline, the amplitude reactive damping is a feature they added after studying what happened the first time. You know, I actually talked to the guy in San Antonio, and yeah, they recovered the old shocks. They looked at them. They sent Ridgelines out on this road, the first generation one back in 2006 or something in that time frame, ran it, decided, yeah, they might need to keep an eye on this and do something. I think they monitored what was going on with warranty claims and realized that they could probably wait until the full redesign happened rather than do some kind of a running change. I don't know. This is me speculating in my head. But this full redesign, the guy talked about amplitude reactive damping, and I kind of went up and asked him, well, what's that? And, you know, kind of knowing what it was because I've been inside shocks before. And, yeah, it's basically got two different damping circuits, one for small amplitudes and one for larger ones. And I think what's going on here is the washboard road is just underneath the threshold to trigger the second one, which might, you know, if you hit a pothole or some really deep hole, it would engage, but maybe not on this. So it amounts to a bypass, I think. It's just not developing as much damping force and as much heat. I think that's what it boils down to. And also, as I pointed out in the video, this is an independent suspension truck. You know, there's a lot less unsprung mass. And on a washboard road, it's the weight of the suspension that matters, not the weight of the truck. You know, the truck's kind of floating along at the top and the suspension is hammering up and down underneath it. You know, it's a term, skyhook, that you may have heard referring to damping theory. That has to do with, you know, you assume the truck is level and the wheel's hammering up and down. So it's the weight of the mass, it's the mass of the suspension that matters. And here, you know, there's a lot less of it. It's an independent suspension.
So I have to ask, I don't know what your opinion of the Ridgeline was before you did this test, but I'm going to assume you're like many journalists who think it's just unique. It's different, you know, and we don't think of it as a true off-road truck. How much did your opinion change of the truck, or was it the same when you got done with it?
Well, I have to say it changed quite a bit. And if I go back to, you know, when I first joined Edmunds in 2006, you know, that first Ridgeline was still in the fleet, but the trip had already happened before I got hired, so I only heard about it. But, you know, as a person who had done, you know, work for Toyota in the 90s, you know, I looked at that truck and it kind of, that's not a truck. I had the same reaction a lot of people had. You know, what's going on there? That's a minivan, right? And, but, you know, as time passed and I've driven a lot more vehicles in this job, like you do when you're in the automotive journalism space. And then I think back about other experiences I've had. You know, when I worked at the Toyota Proving Ground, I lived in a little town called Wickenburg, And the shortest drive to work was a dirt road. And I drove a whole bunch of different vehicles. I had an 80 series Land Cruiser. I had a Tacoma pre-runner. And then I had a RAV4, the first generation one. These are, you know, cars that I leased as an employee. And my wife owned this like Chevy Nova that was one of those Toyota Corolla Novas built in Fremont. And the thing was, is on that dirt road, which had a couple of potholes, and, you know, but I knew the line to avoid the deep ones. The Nova was probably the most fun, and I could horse around the most with that, mainly because I didn't care if I bent a rim. But at the same time, you know, that and the RAV4 had least unsprung mass, and, you know, a Land Cruiser 80 series is great in the rocks and it's great for rock crawling. And, you know, but if you're just driving the dirt road to get to the trailhead, it's there's a lot of mass in that suspension and it can kind of beat you up. Meanwhile, the RAV4 just glides over that stuff. When it gets to the rocks, it can't go anywhere. And that's kind of the same thing with the Ridgeline. The Ridgeline, you know, is great getting somewhere on a dirt road that's reasonable shape. But once you get to any place where you got clearance issues or rock crawling to do, it can't go there. You know, that's one of the reasons why we went in and out to the racetrack. There's a big loop you can make, but after you pass the racetrack, you remember there was a sign that said high clearance 4x4 recommended. They mean it after the racetrack if you decide to do the loop. But so it's pretty... it's pretty good at, you know, that sort of road, you know, up to that point. That's its limit, but it does really well. And then, you know, it's got a good sized bed. You can put 4x8 sheets of plywood flat on the deck in the back of it, and it actually has a higher rated payload than the Tacoma for double cab. You know, as long as you're not doing the off road part of it beyond this, it's not bad at all.
Which is,
so yeah, my opinion changed.
Yeah, and that's Honda's argument, is that the most people just do that kind of off roading, and they don't use their trucks as much as the capability is built into them, and so this is an alternative to that kind of vehicle.
Yeah, I think you can take it even further. There's a lot of people that never put their pavement, never take their trucks off pavement, in certain parts of the country. But, you know, at the same time, if this particular road had been in a place where they get more rain, you know, it doesn't really rain very much in Death Valley, any maybe. So if there was a place where there was rain or a threat of washouts or anything like that, you know, it'd be really easy to stop this truck in its tracks if there was some kind of unforeseen circumstances, which is, you know, what off-roading is about sometimes.
Sure. What kind of reaction have you gotten from the manufacturers? Has he reached out to you to talk to you about the story?
Radio silence.
Really? That's interesting. I figured there'd be some reaching out. So what's next?
Well, there might be, but it's only been a week. I'm sure they're still figuring it all out.
Right. What's next on the agenda? You going to take the Tacoma back out with some bigger shocks?
I'd like to. You know, that's a vehicle that's in our long-term test fleet. Mm-hmm. It's a vehicle that we're supposed to get rid of after a year, but, you know, it's been so handy that we've had it longer than that. And so, we, you know, it's time to cycle it out and replace it with something else. But, you know, yeah, I'd like to grab a set of larger Bilsteins and put them on the back and see what happens. And because I really think that's big factor here. Now you go to the Titan and it had the bigger ones, but the Titan's a whole different animal. You know, it's a heavy duty truck. Its tires are at 65 PSI or whatever. And because it's a heavy duty truck, you know, those axles weigh more, all the running gear weighs more. It's got a ton more unsprung weight. A ton isn't really right, but a lot more. And so I don't know, that it could just be that they're not enough.
Yeah. That truck, and we didn't talk about it too much, but that truck got beat up pretty well on this test.
And
And it wasn't a test. I mean, you didn't really plan to test. It just happens to be what happened.
No, I mean, that's the thing, is if we would have conceived this as a test, we may have approached the Tacoma and the Titan differently. We may have, you know, been a little bit more you know, had a little bit of a meeting beforehand about, look, don't try to keep up with me if you feel, you know, like something isn't right, but, you know, run your own speed kind of thing. But since this was a ridgeline test and they were just following, they just matched my speed. And, you know, it could be that driving the Tacoma and the Titan slower would have been something we would have done if they were the lead vehicle. And that was the subject of the test. You know, the driver might have been feeling that out. But since the ridgeline was the subject of the test and they were just matching it, it could be that, you know, they would have survived driven 5 miles an hour slower, 10 miles an hour slower. But at the same time, that kind of, it's the same result in a different form, right? The ridgeline can go quicker and without incurring damage. So it still is better suited to this type of road. Just this type of road, though.
Right. What's your takeaway? What in the end of the day, when you sit back and think about this really cool story you came up with, what really stands out to you?
I think it's really just respect for washboard. I mean, I didn't really go in thinking about it that much. I just figured this would be a cakewalk for the other two trucks. And I figured that this was just a question of whether or not the ridgeline would bear up. And also it kind of proves that, you know, all the overlanders who spend money on shocks and tires, you know, people who are going to drive this type of road and worse all the time, you know, aren't necessarily, I mean, they may be doing it because they like the idea of having a set of icons on their truck, but at the same time, and it looks cool and they get to lift it and all of that, there's a real functional reason to do it.
Sure.
You know, the people who are selling this stuff, you know, automakers are building trucks to a price. And so there's room for improvement. People do it with tires and suspension all the time. And all this does is really underline the fact that, you know, that's not wasting money. You know, there's some real benefit to doing it. So,
sure. Well, where can people find the second part of the story? Is it going to be at Edmunds.com?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that are out there. There are the two videos now that are on the Edmunds YouTube channel. And Edmunds.com, there's a written story that goes into a little bit more detail and explains things like it gets 120 degrees in Death Valley, but on the day we were there, and this is important, it was between 75 and 80 degrees. Heat didn't really play a factor in this. The story makes that abundantly clear, and the video edit doesn't as well. And then there's a couple of follow-up long-term road test stories, one for each vehicle. Well, actually two for the Tacoma, because another one dropped today. So there's about four or five pieces of content floating around with respect to this. So yeah, Edmunds.com and the Edmunds YouTube channel.
It's great stuff. Really, really great videography done. Really good story. Yeah.
Really fun. Knocked out the park.
Yeah, it's a really, check it out. We'll have it on our Facebook page too. I'll have links to that story as well on Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. And we're right back with more. Thank you for being on the podcast. I always forget that part, my guess.
Oh, great. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. It's fun to talk about it.
And we'll be right back with more Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. And finally on today's show, I want to talk about something that's going on right now. Right now. Right now. This Sunday, Sunday, Sunday. No. Right now, I'm on a road trip with the family. We went to Michigan. We are hanging out at my dad's house. And what's cool with this road trip is we're switching vehicles. I had a Land Cruiser on the way out. We did some off-roading with it. I have a Chevy Silverado, the High Desert package, which, by the way, looks like an Avalanche. It has RAM boxes. And it's got a hidden storage kind of compartment for groceries in the back of the bed. Check out the photos on our Facebook page on Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. It's very interesting. I'll have more on that later. But I want to get to the next vehicle coming to rotation is the following week. We're going to drive a Nissan Pathfinder. And I bring this up because I was talking to Nissan, and they're actually going to get what's called ORV tags for this. This is the off-road recreational vehicle tags that you have in Michigan. They're going to put these stickers on the back, and they're going to point some trails to me. I'm going to go up north, and we're going to go up north through and UP through Wisconsin, you know, that kind of route process. And they want me to take some trails. And for those who know, the old Pathfinder used to be the body-on-frame SUV like the 4Runner. And the new Pathfinder is definitely not a body-on-frame SUV. It's definitely more of a three-row mommy kind of SUV. However, they are determined that I'm going to get this thing dirty and get to the trails, and that the title of the story will ultimately be, your car is more capable than you think off-roading. Yes. So I thought it was a very interesting thing. I'm excited to do the story. Excited to find somebody that's going to buy the story. That'd be the second part of that. Or put it on our website. SUVs these days are a lot more capable. You have the Jeep Cherokee with its off-road features. I mean, you know, it's more capable than we think of a SUV would be. I guess that's one example I can think of. Ford Explorer is probably more capable than what people would make it out to be. A Nissan Pathfinder, yeah. I mean, so think about this. Would you take a Pathfinder, a Highlander would be another competitor, a Mazda CX-9? Would you take those off-roading, Jill?
So CX-9, no, absolutely not. So the interesting thing is, I don't know if you attended Nissan did a program probably about a year ago where they launched the refreshed Pathfinder and the Armada. And, I literally think it was exactly a year ago, 'cause I got the memory on my phone, because it was, I was running hills there and there was a fire and there's like orange in the background.
California. I happened to be in Hawaii doing a Tacoma drive.
Okay. So I happened to be on this drive, and what they did for the drive is the Armada, you know, they had us do a lot of on-road driving, but then they took us to this really spiffy off-road course with articulation and hills and, you know, bumps and things, and it actually was really capable, did a really great job. And so then the next day, you know, we were driving the Pathfinder, and it was one of those half-day deals where you did, like, a quick on-road trip, and then we went back. I think we were, like, at a ranch or something like that, and we did, like, basically a dirt path. So mild off-roading, it could totally handle. And I have pictures of the dusty Pathfinder, you know, that we drove after we got it off the trail. But serious off-roading?
I don't think it can do serious off-roading, but I think it could. I don't know.
Some mild dirt roads and paths. I can definitely see it. And it did it. You know, it was fine. I think they were saying, yeah, you know, you can go over the river and through the woods, literally to grandmother's house. But I mean, is it going to be able to do what the Armada can do? No, it can't. But can it get a little dirty? It can. It can.
Yeah, so I'm just really curious. Again, the rep lives in this area, and he's going to give me some trails that are designated that he knows are good. And so I'm really curious to see what I'm going to face, if I'm going to get stuck, what kind of obstacles there are. Because
they're not going to put you on something that they haven't already done, I would think.
I would think so too. But I don't know. It's gonna be an interesting trip up there. I'll have the family with me, and so there'll be the extra stress of having the kids in the back seats and the wife with me, and trying to navigate these trails we've never been on, and knowing that we have to get to our next destination at some point during the day. So it's gonna be an interesting experience. I'm very curious to see how it does. in a real application. I have a lot of dirt roads around me. I know it does fine there. I've driven it on those. It's fine. But I mean, really putting that to the test to say, you know, if you live up on a, I don't know, you got a hillside mountain house, and every once in a while the trail gets a little gnarly, instead of taking your old 75 Bronco, can you take the new Pathfinder? I mean, that's kind of the question. Are cars more capable than we think they are? I know it's sports cars are easy, right? So sports cars are always more capable than people put them out to be, right?
Just not in the same way. You're not going to take those on a dirt road.
Right. But it, yeah. It's,
I'm just going to put that out there.
Yeah, I'm not doing Corvette on a dirt road. But yeah, I mean, it's the same thought process in that, you know, people don't use the vehicles to their full capability quite often on a whole. And so to take this Pathfinder out and actually see if it's capable enough to take the family on a road trip and also swing by and do some trails while we're in the area, I think it's a very interesting thing. So I will have a full count how many times we ding the paint, get stuck, or spin the tires on an upcoming podcast. Actually, I had to make an announcement. There will be no podcast next week. I will be in a tent in Wisconsin, and I'm pretty sure I won't be able to have enough signal to do a podcast. I'm not going to. I did think about driving out to Chicago to see you, but it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So, yeah. So
whatever. You just don't want to see me in person. That's fine.
Actually, I see you so much on Skype, it may be awkward to see you in person. all right, we digress. All right, here's the deal. Make sure you check out pickuptrucktalk.com for all your latest stories and also more behind the scenes. There's a lot of good stuff on Facebook lately. I've been posting like a lot, so check it out on Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. Twitter, email me at tim@pickuptrucktalk.com. Dan talked about a few stories on his interview. We're going to have those links in the bottom of the show notes. My Twitter handle and Jill's Twitter handle will be on there. Make sure you tweet at us any questions, comments, concerns, hatreds. All the good stuff.
Only good things. No hatred.
Yeah. No trolling. We don't feed the trolls, and make sure you check us out on iTunes at subscribe, because at some point I'm going to learn how many subscribers I have. So hit that subscribe button. And again, no podcast next week. We will be back with you the week after, and we'll have more adventures with Tim and Jill and our craziness, and we'll see you down the road. We'll be right back.